Okay, yeah, welcome everyone. So for those who don't know me, I'm Steph. I'm a postdoc in the pickle since almost a year now, but yeah, working from home all the time. So I'm very happy to welcome Markus Feil today to our pickle seminar. Markus is from the Max Planck Institute for the Physics of Complex Systems in Dresden, Germany, and he's doing great research in the broad area of dynamics of quantum many-body systems. And today he will show us how to use artificial neural networks to simulate dynamics of two-dimensional quantum systems. So please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the introduction and also for the invitation and to present some of our results at this occasion. So, as already advertised, I'm a quantum many-body dynamics person, and I would like to tell you about some of the things that we have been doing in this direction, and in particular to use machine learning techniques or ideas from machine learning and concepts from machine learning for that purpose. Now, before I start, let me say two more things. On the one hand, please at any point interrupt me if there's an unclear point or if you have a question. And the second is that I would like to acknowledge one particular person in all of this endeavor, and that's Markus Schmidt, who has been a postdoc with me few years ago, then moved to Berkeley, and now is located since recently in Cologne, Germany. And yeah, without his persistent efforts, all of what I will be showing you would not have been possible. So, as I was mentioning, it's the talk is about quantum many-body dynamics, and typically, in the context that I will be mainly focusing on, this will mean dynamics far from equilibrium, not to a in a kind of linear response regime of weakly perturbing systems, but rather in the regime which drives systems far from equilibrium. Now, let me start my whole talk by outlining that although we are maybe very well familiar with the fact that many physical systems or physical states can be described by equilibrium statistical ensembles or by equilibrium descriptions, there are very important instances of non-equilibrium states. And of course, these are the ones we would like to understand in more detail. And this crosses over through various scales. On the largest scales, the most important non-equilibrium system that we have is the universe itself. Of course, if it were in equilibrium, there would be no solar systems or whatever where we could live as human beings. On much smaller scales, you can see here biological organisms, which can only survive upon sustaining a non-equilibrium state with their environment. Now, I would not dare to describe such complex non-equilibrium scenarios. What I would like to focus on are certain classes of non-equilibrium states that can be generated on a very controlled level in systems which now go under the name of quantum simulators. And so what they have achieved in the end within the last two decades is nothing but to realize the most pristine version of the fundamental equation of quantum mechanics, which is Schrödinger's equation, under very controlled conditions and to in its most pristine form. So in the end, what I would like to study in the following is nothing but Schrödinger's equation and solutions of Schrödinger's equation for many-body systems, and in particular for those regimes where the solution of this of Schrödinger's equation is extremely challenging. And this amounts to the fact to the case where these particles are strongly interacting, and also beyond the regime of one spatial dimensions where things are in one dimension, things are rather easy to describe. And we would like to go now the next step, which I will also motivate and outline in more detail. So in the end, that's the main content of our research, to understand the solutions of Schrödinger's equation for many-body systems. But as I would like to outline in the beginning, there are severe challenges in solving Schrödinger's equation when it comes to the limit of two spatial dimensions. on the one hand, I would like to outline these challenges, but also to motivate why studying quantum dynamics in two spatial dimensions is very important and very timely at this moment. After introducing the challenges, I would like to show you like one solution, which like in a simpler form, like we term classical networks, but in a more general context, fall under this name of artificial neural network wave functions that I would like to introduce. And then I would also like outline, although the idea is very, very simple, appealing, I would outline also challenges within this approach to push this or make this approach overall competitive to other existing techniques. And in particular, I would like to focus on one problem, which one might call the inversion problem, and which whose solution is essential to stabilize the dynamics and to reach regimes that are competitive with other methods and to really push the solution of Schrödinger's equation in two dimensions significantly further. And in the end, I would like to give you an outlook on what might be possible with this technique in the future. So let me first start with a general introduction in quantum dynamics in two spatial dimensions. So I think it's fair to say that we are currently actually at a key turning point, both in theory and experiments. So starting from experiments, there's actually a huge effort recently to access the coherent quantum dynamics of quantum many-body systems in 2D, meaning essentially implementing Schrödinger's equation for some paradigmatic model systems like Ising models or XY models in two spatial dimensions. And just within the last year, there have been incredible developments in the context of Rydberg atoms. However, on the theory side, when it comes to describing these systems, there we are facing a severe limitation when it comes to numerically exact methods, which is that when we study here, like the availability of methods and their working functioning as a function of dimension, we have extremely powerful methods when it comes to spatial dimension one, which can be summarized under the general framework of tensor network methods. And on the limit of high dimensions, we actually also have asymptotically exact methods, which go under the name of dynamical mean field theory. And both of them are extremely successful in their limits, but both of them also face severe limitations when you want to approach the intermediate regime of dimension two and dimension three. So this can be either like limitations by spatial resolution in the context of dynamical mean field theory, or entanglement or like related limitations when it comes to tensor network methods. So this leaves us with a huge gap in obviously physically relevant dimensions of two and three. And that's where we would like to advance now with our technique. So now what is so challenging overall to study? Why is non-equilibrium quantum dynamics such a difficult problem? And so the overall reason for that is very simple. Most of you are very well aware of is that overall, the Hilbert space, like the space in which quantum mechanical wave functions live in, is an exponentially large object. So practically what it means is that if you have a generic quantum many-body state, like which we denote by this psi, and if we represent it in some computational basis, or some basis of spin configuration, say, like all the information of the quantum state is then stored in all these amplitudes psi of s. So for each spin configuration, we have one of these amplitudes. But now the problem is that overall, there are many such spin configurations when it comes to a large number n of such spins. So that in the end, to store like the full information about the quantum state, that's in general like an exponentially hard problem or like requires exponential resources because we would have to store exponentially of those of these amplitudes in case there's no efficient compression. Like in one dimension, we have such an efficient compression when it comes to these tensor network states. But in case we don't have such a compression, we are facing that problem, because especially when it comes to non-equilibrium dynamics, it seems like these states are more or less following this worst case scenario that we have to store exponentially many of those amplitudes to accurately represent our wave function. So that's the problem. And like, what is now our idea to solve this? The idea is actually not even trying to store these amplitudes. So not trying to do this, because that seems to be in two and three spatial dimensions an exponentially hard problem. Rather imagine that we can generate those amplitudes on the fly when we need them. So what we envision here is a machine which accepts as an input a spin configuration, and suppose, and that machine gives us as an output a wave function amplitude psi tilde of s, which we hope is a good approximation to the actual amplitude that we would like to have. Suppose we have such a machine, we could imagine to sample from such a machine by just using conventional Monte Carlo techniques. But of course, the obvious objection is, yeah, man, but you're now just like replacing the complexity of solving Schrödinger's equation to the complexity of that machine. Is it at all possible to have such a machine? Is this realistic or is this hopeless? And what I would like to convince you in the following, that it's, at least we know already quite a few cases where it's possible to construct such a machine in the end. And with this, we circumvent the problem of storing the amplitudes, but we just generate them when we need them. So now, how do we do this? How do we generate such machines? I would like to start with very briefly, just to mention this, like a very specific class of such machines, which might be familiar in one way or the other already from the equilibrium context, maybe. But we call this, in this non-equilibrium context, classical networks. And the idea is that if this is not like a general purpose approach, but this is an approach which works well if you have a system with a well-defined, with a classic limit. So this classic limit doesn't need to be like simple. It can be still a spin glass problem, say, but it should be a classic limit. And it's a way within these classical networks, we somehow expand around the classic limit. So you can see here like that we introduce for this amplitude some effective classical Hamiltonian. And this is exactly doing what I was trying to now hand wavily describe. It's constructed in a perturbative manner around some exactly solvable classical limit in the end. And it's very similar to other kind of variational wave functions, which you might be aware of, like Jastrow or Hughes and Elzer wave functions. But what I would like to emphasize here, like that's a very controlled approach. You have a small parameter in which you can expand and which allows you to get controlled results. And here I would like to show you a few examples which hopefully convince you a bit that this is extremely successful for such tailored problems where you have a classic limit. Of course, what we did, we compared to like exact solution of a 1D quantum Ising chain, but that's not super exciting. Like the one in the center, I find the most exciting one. So that's for a many body localized system. So like a system which is strongly disordered and interacting. And actually for such systems, it is known that there exists a good classic limit around which we can expand. That's a so-called L-bit model. But it's difficult to generate actually an exact L-bit formulation. And with this approach that I just outlined very briefly here, actually we could show that one can solve MBL problems extremely efficiently and extremely accurately. So for instance, what you can see here is like the entanglement entropy as a half, like we take a one-dimensional chain and compute the entanglement entropy of the half chain as a function of time starting from some unentangled simple initial product state. And what you can see here is, on the one hand, exact diagonalization data. These are these crosses or these symbols, and the solution by this effective classical description. So of our machine that I was advertising before, and these are the solid lines. And as you can see, this approach is extremely accurate over decades of time. So please note the times here, like this is times which are exponentially long, but still we are able to track the essentially exact dynamics of such an MBL system for large systems and large times. So here in this experiment comparison, this was like with exact diagonalization, but we can also do hundreds of spins with this approach of these classical networks. But it's still like asymptotically exact and works extremely well. But that's only for tailored problems and very specific ones where we can expand around classical limits. Of course, we would like to have a more general purpose approach.
So Marcus, can I just add, just to understand this, so is the idea that you expanded around the L-bit limit in this case? So you had to, but you had to find the L-bit Hamiltonian first, right?
Or was exactly. So like, like already that is a non-trivial problem, finding the L-bit Hamiltonian. We were considering here a very specific regime of weak interactions. You can see the small number V here. That's actually weak interactions. And for weak interactions, we actually, like the L-bit Hamiltonian can be rather easily constructed in some perturbative way in terms of the interactions. Because the non-interacting level, we know exactly the L-bits. And that's how this goes a bit like. It's tailored here to the weakly interacting regime, where we can find this L-bit Hamiltonian very reliably and then do the expansion around this point in the end.
Got it, cool.
It would not work for large interactions here, say. We would face problems. So this only works here in this particular regime. But what I would like to advertise here, so you can find such machines. These are just specific problems, but we can translate Schrödinger's equation to such machines. We can construct them, and they can even capture such non-trivial dynamics as such many-body localized systems, where you end up in, say, like volume loss states in the end, which are extremely hard to capture using other techniques. We want to go one step further, of course, like general purpose, also like potentially at some point being able to address the strongly interacting limit of such systems. And that leads me now to these artificial neural networks. And now expanding this is like, the idea is more or less now straightforward that, now we replace this machine by an artificial neural network. Artificial neural network, or simple at least, feed-forward networks are a very complex input-output black boxes. Yeah? You have some input on one side, which is now again a spin configuration. And the output for us is now a number, which is this wave function amplitude, or hopefully a good approximation thereof. So that's how it looks like in like schematically, degree of freedom. So each spin that we have some input neuron, which can take either the value plus or minus one, depending on the spin configuration that you're currently using as an input. Then we have some internal processing, which is highly non-linear, and that's of course important. And the output in the end is then the wave function amplitude that we would like to have. So now, why is this overall a good idea at all to use an artificial neural network, despite of the fact that it realizes such a simple input-output formalism? The enabling idea behind is that neural networks are so-called universal function approximators, which means that when I put in sufficiently many of those neurons and these connections, I can approximate any function I would like to. So also like the wave function amplitude that I'm searching for. This means that any quantum state in prints, like by fundamental principles, can be encoded in such a in such a neural network, provided the neural network is sufficiently large. So this now has two main consequences that I would like to emphasize. On the one hand, many machine learning approaches are sometimes like black box kind of things. So you don't know what your black box is actually doing and how you don't know, is it actually accurate or not, what it tells you. Here, the fact that they are universal function approximators means that they're not like, what we are doing here is not like using a black box, but it becomes a numerically exact approach, because we always know that upon increasing the size of the neural network, we always have to converge to the numerically exact solution in principle, if there are no other problems arising. But in other words, the actual wave function we're looking at is always in the subspace of functions that can be represented by this machine. So the machine always exists, this we know. And a second important aspect is that, so like we have this convergence parameter always in our problem. Upon increasing the size of the neural network, we have to converge to the exact solution. And like another aspect that's like, I cannot briefly and not quickly explain this, but the overall complexity of the algorithm that we will have is only polynomial in the system size and in the size of the neural network. So if the network is not too large, we can solve the whole problem always in polynomial time. And that's fantastic in principle, in terms of complexity.
So that means finding the optimal parameters, you know that it's polynomial in time to find the optimal parameters of the neural network?
Yes, when you do real-time dynamics, you know that, like, I will show this later on, what you have to solve is a nonlinear differential equation. And this nonlinear differential equation, to solve this nonlinear equation, differential equation, the effort only scales polynomial in the size of the net and in terms of system size. But of course, you don't know how a priori how the size of the neural net depends on system size or like other parameters of your algorithm.
Right.
That's of course a priori not at all clear. So disclaimer here, this looks nice, but of course we will not be able to solve the full like the whole many body problem here, because like it's certainly clear that there will be cases where the size of the neural network has to be itself exponential in terms of the system size. But on the other hand, and that's what like which was surprising to myself, like, and I will, as I would like to emphasize at a later point also, when it comes to the dynamics that we are currently looking at, the size of the neural network is not the problem. We are not yet in the limit that the size of the neural network is our limiting factor. Although we'd love to be at that limit, we are not there. So in other words, we don't have to worry at the moment too much about the size of the neural network for the practical, for the concrete cases that we so far look at.
What about the structure of the neural networks and its correlation with the underlying Hamiltonian?
Yes, so of course one can imagine that there's like certain neural networks work better than others for a particular tasks. And we see this also a bit, but unfortunately the problem is not the network. The problem lies at a different end. So we don't have yet to explore too much. So like the structure of the networks, because it turns out that they are not in any way limiting factors, or like you don't get huge improvements by taking more sophisticated network structures at the moment. So we don't have yet a problem in terms of the expressivity of the net. And therefore we don't care so much about whether they are extremely suitable or not for the problem we are looking at.
All right, sounds good.
But of course, like there are some natural guesses that say, when you have a local Hamiltonian, so a Hamiltonian with only short range interactions, that when you study its dynamics, that you might also would like to have a neural network which has this locality built in somewhat. So thinking about convolutional neural networks is probably much much advantages as compared to RBMs, because these long range couplings anyway don't matter initially for a short range Hamiltonian, because correlations build up locally and you don't have to care so much about these long range things. So certainly they are a bit better, but like they are, since they are not limiting factors, we don't care so much yet about this. Okay.
Thanks.
Can I ask a question? So like in this complexity of the algorithm, you say polynomial, does it account for like the convergence of say the cost function you're looking for?
So I would have to be careful when I would apply this approach to searching for ground states. Say one can also use this approach to do ground state search. And there, of course, this is not so clear, like the complexity, the scaling of the complexity of the algorithm, because in the end, what you do is in one way or the other, you're doing cooling. You cool your system to the ground state. But cooling always has the problem if you have, like if you have a system with a small gap, and these are typically the systems which are most challenging and most interesting, you have a problem. And at least that's something you have to account for in estimating the complexity of the algorithm. When it comes to real-time dynamics, the situation is, however, different, as I would like to try to explain a bit later. Okay?
Okay.
Does that answer your question a bit?
I look forward to hearing the rest.
Okay.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, so I guess, I don't know if this question is too naive or not. So I guess typically the ML problem is only dealing with say input real numbers and output real numbers, but yeah. In real time dynamics, you might expect that your wave function amplitude might be a complex number in general. So I'm just wondering at which part the complex number come into the problem, yeah.
I will not this. I will not be. I've not planned to discuss this in detail, but there are issues where you have to be careful a bit. There's no fundamental problem, but you have to be careful a bit in translating things that work well in the conventional machine learning case where you deal with real numbers and. To this non-equilibrium problem. So let me give one example. Mm-hmm. So when you're familiar with say feedforward networks, then or convolutional networks, whatever, you have always some choices for activation functions. Uh-huh. But when you take the conventional activation functions and extend them to the complex plane, they typically lead to, they develop singularities in the complex plane. So for instance, take log-cosh, say. Log-cosh is of course well-defined on the real axis, but on the imaginary axis, a logarithm of cosine is not well-defined. You will see, of course, divergences when the cosine goes to zero. And that can cause problems and instabilities. So there are some things you have to think about and like to figure out. It took us, all these things took us honestly 3 years to figure out. Yeah,
okay.
It was a big endeavor. And that's why the credit to Markus Schmidt is so, I would rate so high, because he was going through all these details and finding out where are like potential problems. And this was actually one of them. So you have to be careful in choosing activation functions here.
Uh-huh. Okay, thanks. And is it possible to, like, I don't know, choose other type of activation functions that like, I don't know, like not the conventional ML type in, but it's more suitable for this kind of complex number problems or?
I would not say we have found a good solution. What we were doing practically, it was the easiest one to avoid singularities. We were just taking the conventional ones and we're using a Taylor expansion of them to some power.
I see, okay.
And that automatically avoids the issue of singularities. but there can be certainly more elegant ones or more cleverer ones, I'm sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, so now let me, I mentioned already a few problems with this approach. Now let me be more specific. Like that was very general, like on the principal idea. And like polynomial also sounds fine in terms of complexity, but I would also like to point out that there have been also like problems in using practically this approach. And like, I would like to show two examples. One example actually goes back to one of the organizers Stephanie, and who realized the following thing, which I would like to discuss them in more detail later on. And what you can see is like all examples of using such a, using this idea. So like the idea is actually not ours, and like it's older, like goes back to Kalia and Troia. So forgot to emphasize this. We didn't come up with this idea. And these were other attempts to use that and to use this approach for real-time dynamics. Here, for instance, in the pioneering paper by Giuseppe Kalia and Matthias Troyer. And this is dynamics for like the paradigmatic one-dimensional quantum Ising chain, but details are not so important. What I would like to point out here is that as a function of real time during this non-equilibrium process, you can see already partially at relatively short times deviations of the exact solution, which are the dashed lines, and the solution from this artificial neural network. So like here, it's like only a, one might wonder, okay, maybe we would have to just increase the neural net because maybe we are not good enough in terms of our machine yet, say. But then Stephanie, was pointing out the following problem. So again, here, one-dimensional Ising problem, but is not, again, so important what model it is exactly. So what is important is that you what they compared is like the exact solution, which is this black line here, with various different solutions that you obtain using this artificial neural network approach upon increasing the size of the neural network, alpha here. Like increasing alpha means increasing the size of the neural network. And according to what I was telling you before, upon increasing the size of the neural network, we should always converge to the exact solution, according to the general idea that I was proposing before. But now when you look closely at the actual data, what you find is that at short times, everything is fine. But at some point, you start to depart from the exact black solution, and you go to this upper branch here. So like that by itself is not crucial, but what it seems like that upon increasing the size of the neural net, you don't converge to the exact solution, but you seem to converge to a different one, to a different solution, which of course poses like a fundamental question on this approach. Yeah, why should, like, you should converge to the actual solution. So what is happening here? And what I would like to outline in the following is that we now understand like at least parts of what can cause such a problem, not following the exact solution, and how you can make it converge, and how can you realize that you're actually starting to depart from the exact solution. And before I come to that, let me first like show you what kind of system we have been studying for that purpose. And then again, like one of the standard models, paradigmatic models, two-dimensional Ising model on a square lattice. So square lattice, on each lattice point, you have a spin 1/2. These spins are coupled ferromagnetically, nearest neighbor, like, and we have quantum fluctuations induced by the transverse field. And we do a rather simple non-equilibrium setup here that we initialize the system initially in the spin, like all spin pointing to the right or left, depending on how you see that now. Which means just like the ground state of the transverse field part here. Yeah. And then we, after this preparation, we just do time evolution with this full Hamiltonian. So you can think of this as a quantum quench from like vanishing, coupling, initializing your system in a paramagnetic phase, And now you're doing dynamics with the full transverse field IC model. And here you can see our results for different values of the transverse field, where HC denotes the critical field, that where you would have the ground state quantum phase transition in that model. And you can see various data, and I apologize that we have so much data in here, but what is important is that what we compare here is the this dashed line here, which corresponds to an exact IPEPS calculation from that, taken from that paper. And you can see various other data obtained using the artificial neural network wave functions. So taken like to increase, say like the size of the neural network, concretely these have been CNNs, convolutional neural networks here. So like to show that we can converge to some, that we show convergence. And as you can see, we can achieve nice convergence at some point. And in particular, the timescales we can reach are significantly larger than what you can get with IPEPS in this context. So we can get it under control. And now I would like to show you why, what we did to get it that far. The inversion problem. So where is one key problem that leads to leads to issues? So overall, as I would like to explain to you, there are instabilities in this algorithm, and many instabilities. I will concentrate on one here, but there are also more, like as I was explaining with these activation functions, with the singularities, that's also like leading to potential instabilities. But I would like to focus on a more fundamental one, I think. So again, the setup, we want to find these amplitudes for wave functions. And in particular, we want to solve like Schrödinger's equation. And therefore, we are aiming at identifying these time-dependent wave function amplitudes. And so using this machine, in the end, it's the same thing as like having a variational wave function. We have some object which depends on some parameters, like of parameters of the neural network, the weights, the biases, the activation function, weights and biases. So all of these are certain parameters that parameterize our wave function. And in that context, you can just think of like we are introducing just a very complicated variation wave function. So what we aim to do is we aim to find the amplitudes parameterized by these variation parameters in such a way that we most closely get to the actual desired solution. Yeah? But how do we get this without knowing the exact solution? We want to go beyond the limit of what can be done with other methods. So how do we do that? In the end, it's a rather like general problem, not only of artificial neural networks, like just of variation wave functions. So suppose you have your state in your like your variational wave function at some time t, and now you want to propagate it over a small time step delta t, you will get now this new wave function here. The problem is that now this new wave function time evolved with the exact Hamiltonian will be not exactly in the variational subspace, but slightly away from that. So what you want to do is you want to project back to your variational subspace upon optimizing this fidelity. So you want to optimize the overlap of the exact time evolved state with the with the state which is closest to this time evolved one. So you're looking for the supremum of this F of all your variation parameters. But in dynamics, and it's now different from ground state search, in dynamics, you have a deterministic description of how to do that. You don't have to run a global optimization to do that. That's the difference to like ground state search. You can do an expansion for small time steps. And when you do this expansion, what you find is that following the global minimum of your variation manifold, like the optimal representation, in order to follow this global minimum, you have to solve a nonlinear classical differential equation. But that's something very general for variation wave functions. So you translate the quantum many-body Schrödinger equation to a classical differential equation for your variational parameters. And this is how it looks like in short forms, like this. These are the changes of your variational, of your weights, of your variational parameters. And then you have a matrix S here. I'm assuming Einstein summation. So like there's actually a sum over K prime imposed here. And there's a vector here on the right-hand side. The details of this S and F, I'm sparing you, like grayed out. Important thing is like you know how to compute them in principle. And so if you can solve this exactly, you have solved your time-dependent problem. You would invert this matrix, bring it to the other side. You solve your classical differential equation and you're done. Yeah. And what this would give you is, as I said, like it would like to, it will tell you how to follow the optimum, optimal global minimum of in your variational manifold as a function of time, step by step. And that's the point here. What can happen if you don't solve this equation exactly, that you can be trapped in wrong minima. And once you are in the wrong minimum and you follow that wrong minimum, you're of course lost and you will never able to get back to the exact solution. And that's exactly what happened here. And what happens almost naturally if you're like not aware of what I would like to tell you in the following. And the problem is that it's said very easy like that. You just have to invert this matrix. The problem is, of course, the matrix is not invertible. And that by itself might not be even like super a big problem, because actually there's like a rather well understanding how to invert non-invertible matrices. There's a notion of a pseudo inverse, and there are various techniques in still inverting, solving such equations and inverting this matrix S. But now comes something which I have not yet emphasized significantly. In the end, we are using Monte Carlo techniques to compute the matrix elements of S and also of this vector on the right-hand side, F. That's what I was mentioning rather in the beginning, that suppose we have such a machine, like with the simple input-output formalism, we can do Monte Carlo to sample from that machine to get always the amplitudes that we desire. But of course, when doing that, we will always have to deal with error that comes from doing Monte Carlo simulations. So what we have here like are always errors on this matrix element S and on this function F on the right-hand side. So, and this poses an immediate also like question maybe that, so suppose I'm doing a pseudo inverse. When you do a pseudo inverse, you typically put a threshold on your singular values of your matrix S. But what is now, what happens if you have noise now in these singular values? How should you do now the pseudo inverse? Isn't this a big problem? And the key to the solution is that to represent like this equation in the eigenbasis of this matrix S. So we are diagonalizing this matrix S in this form. V is a unitary transformation and sigma square gives you the eigenvalues. And you get a new equation, which is equivalent to the previous one, but just like in a different reference frame. And the equation is now, I will need denote like by sigma square eta tilde dot equal to rho k. And now there's one important observation, which is like a priori maybe non-trivial. So I'd like to go quickly now here, which is that fortunately, the Monte Carlo noise on the singular values themselves is independent of the value, singular value itself. So in other words, the signal to noise ratio for the singular values is only set by the number of Monte Carlo samples that you have. So that's good. Like the Monte Carlo error that you have, say like if you have a singular value of order like 10 to the minus 6, the Monte Carlo the fluctuations due to finite number of Monte Carlo samples, the signal to noise ratio is the same as for a singular value that is like of the order of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6. So that's good. But what we observe is that there's a huge signal to noise ratio here on the right hand side of this for this row elements. So the problem is not like on the left hand side, the problem is on the right hand side that there's a huge signal to noise ratio for the so-called force vector on the right hand side. So what we propose is for invert, like to solving this inversion problem, not to impose a criterion on the singular values, but rather to impose a criterion on the singular to noise, on the signal to noise ratio of the right hand side of the individual elements of this row vector. So you can see here one instance of this row vector. It's that's like just enumerating all the elements of this vector row appearing here and plotting here the signal to noise ratio. And you can see here that there are many elements of this vector which actually have a low signal to noise ratio. So that's just Monte Carlo noise in the end. And there are just a few ones which have a high signal to noise ratio. And what we introduce here is a threshold. And we only take now into account when it comes to solving this equation, those index A, K, where we have a large signal to noise ratio, where we can be sure that what we sample is indeed what it should be, where the error on due to Monte Carlo sampling is small. And we neglect all the remaining stuff here, which is anyway just noise. And it turns out using a regularization of this kind improves dramatically the stability of this neural network approach. And this leaves us now to this, the data that I've been showing you already. And now I'm running out of time. Just mention like one further example that we're currently studying, like this is the Kibbe-Zurich mechanism in 2D, in the 2D transfer speed icing model. And also here we see that we can identify nicely the probably expected, but still like we're not yet shown scaling to occur for of the number of defects in the Kibbe-Zurich mechanism. So just want to like to point out here, like we now really have all of this under control and there's now really room for exploring yet inaccessible regimes with these neural networks. So quick summary, like, I hope I could have shown that now with these tricks and especially with this new regularization scheme, the approach now is competitive or even superior compared to tensor network methods when it comes to dynamics. Increasing system size or time only comes at moderate polynomial costs, but we are still facing instabilities. And this is something I don't want to sweep under the carpet. The problem is still not network size. So we would love to be at that problem, at that limit that the network size is our limiting factor. We still are facing instabilities in solving this classical differential equation. We have gone, like we have achieved quite a lot, but we are still not where we want to be. And that's still what we are currently working on, identifying, understanding the instabilities and that we can still push this further. And with this, I'm done and thanks a lot for your attention. Looking forward to your questions, of course.
Yeah, thank you, Markus. That was great. It's nice to see that you made sense of my simulation outcomes.
No, it was very important, actually. Like, and like, it's really posed like a fundamental question, like, because the general like it was, and we were all also seeing that, and it took us a long time, unfortunately, years to figure it out.
Yeah, that's cool. So do we have questions?
Can I, since I have to go in a minute, can I ask the first question, Steph?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry for going over time, as always.
No, not at all.
Oh, that's good.
No, it's fascinating. Okay, now I kind of forget what I was going to ask, but okay, so is comparison so when you're talking about expressivity and the fact that you're not limited by it, I mean, we always, I guess this is just vague intuition, thought the limiting factor of tensor networks was their expressivity, right? Because you're baking in an area law. So if it's not the limiting factor on your side of things, what do you think accounts for the discrepancy here, or maybe the competitive advantage over tensor networks, you know?
Mm-hmm. So like, let me make it clear. I'm sure at some point, hopefully it will be expressivity. Yeah, it just means that we have not reached the timescales or like the complexity of our like states to reach this limit. Yeah, like let me be clear.
But is that the main bet, that the, you know, the expressivity blows up or the requirements?
Sure, like that's what
I would guess. Yeah.
Exactly. But what we don't know, of course, is like what, where this exponential wall may be, where it appears. Like also for tensor networks, you know that there's an exponential wall for time evolution, but you can still get very far, let's put it that way. So I'm generally, you will not solve the Schrödinger equation in general, I'm sure. So there will be this some exponential wall appearing at some point.
And the exponential wall in tensor networks, you believe is tied to the growth of entanglement as a function of time?
Yes, I mean, exactly. Here, we don't understand, honestly. We know that, and that's like the big thing that I can go also back to like one slide. Like I was showing you with MBL, say. The classical net, like here we go to a volume law state in the end. And we can compute volume law long time states at exponentially long times, which have volume. We compute volume law states in that respect. So a priori, these classical networks are not limited by entanglement. They will certainly have a limitation, but we don't understand. We don't know what it is. So it is not entanglement.
Why do you say that they certainly have a limitation?
Sorry?
Why are you certain they have a limitation?
Because because of the famous there's no Phalange theorem, so the complexity will remain at some point. But it doesn't mean that we cannot push. So I'm sure we can push it somewhere, but I don't think that we will be able to solve the general like harder than NP problem, namely solving Schrödinger's equation for any any problem, I guess. Totally. A bit realistic, although I'm maybe enthusiastic, at least realistic in that I'm not be able to solve a problem which is harder than NP.
Cool, thanks.
Okay, more questions?
Can I ask one? So it's about related to what I asked earlier. You, for instance, and you mentioned it already, if you tweak ground states, then the problem should be harder. But like, you couldn't apply this same strategy if you do imaginary time evolution, right? Or is it different? Or like,
no, ground state search is imaginary time evolution is cooling. So like, you can do a bit of tricks, but in the end, it's always the same. Yeah, you can improve a bit. Like, you can have a bit better cooling strategies or better strategies like how to search for the path, your imaginary time path, but in the end it's like imaginary time evolution, at least asymptotically at low temperatures. And then you just have the problem that if you want to go to the real ground state and your gap is small, your times that you need, like suppose mm-hmm. your gap is exponentially small in system size, the times that you need in order to find the ground state will be exponentially long in imaginary time evolution. And that automatically introduces an exponential factor in the problem.
I see. Thanks.
So it would be probably similar here in general. Like if you were to go to exponentially long real times, that would of course also impose an exponential scale here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Except for this particular case, which is special, where we actually even managed to do this. But in the general neural network problem, this will be an issue.
Right.
Oh, I have a question.
Please, yeah.
So it was probably a little bit following up what Roger was asking. So I guess for this point in the tensor or like MPS type of the algorithm, that there's this parameter that's the bound dimension. So in principle, if you are willing to take bound dimension goes to infinite, then you do get a exact result, like exact dynamics. And I'm just wondering if in this algorithm, is there any kind of parameter that if you are willing to tune, like ideally, that you can actually recover the exact Schrodinger yes. solution?
Yes. And it's the size of the neural network.
Okay, I see.
And that's due to this, it's exactly the size. So like we know that, and there's a mathematical theorem for that. We can always approximate to arbitrary accuracy, psi of s in principle, if we make our neural network large enough.
I see.
But it's like a non-constructive proof. It just like says, if the network is large enough, then you can have an arbitrarily small error.
I see. Okay, thanks.
And exactly. So like the that is exactly then what has been posing like the question that has been posed by Stephanie's work, that here it seems like upon increasing the size of the network, you don't converge to the exact solution, but you should.
Uh-huh. And but in this case, you said it was because it's trapped in some local minimum of the
exactly.
solution.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. You're following the wrong at some point, like you're following the wrong minimum, and then you converge to that minimum.
Yeah. Okay. I see. Okay. Thanks.
So I have a question.
Sorry
for. First, thank you for the great talk. I probably missed some step along the way about how you encode the time evolution specifically. And I was wondering if you learn neural network parameters that evolve with time, or if you use the time as an input for the neural network.
Mm-hmm. Yes, like I was in the end, I was speaking too extensively in the beginning. I was rushing then a bit at the end. So in the end, so what we do here is that with these artificial neural networks, that we introduce like a wave function, which depends on some parameter eta, so that we have these eta parameter dependent amplitudes, and these etas are exactly the parameters of your neural network, the weights, the biases. And what I in the second part, like here showed you outlined, not showed you, outlined very roughly, that now how do you get these etas? How do you have to choose them? And the point is you don't have to do a global optimization. What you do is, what you in the end can formulate is that, or like have to do is solving a classical differential equation which propagates your variational parameters over time. So you have to assume that at like time t equals zero, say, you know your variational parameters already. And when you know them, you know how to propagate them over time. And the way they have to be propagated is captured by this equation.
Okay, so you learn one time slice of your wave function and you propagate the weights.
Exactly. So, exactly. Okay. For the non-equilibrium problems that we were looking at, that was typically no issue because the initial conditions were very simple. So we could write down essentially these etas exactly. Analytically, and therefore this is not a problem. The problem is then only solving this propagation. And there are issues in solving, unfortunately, this.
And this equation. So I understand that that's not exactly what you were concerned with, but are there works that try to use time as a parameter for the neural network directly, like a conditioning of the weights?
The problem is that we don't know yet, maybe there's a way, but like there's nothing known, how you could train your network globally. So the only thing that the only thing that we currently can do is assuming you are in the optimum, that you know, upon changing time slightly, like we can predict like how the landscape, the variation, like the landscape of variation parameters looks like, and where's the new optimum, and we can directly jump to this new optimum. So we are only doing a kind of very local training here. And so therefore, I wouldn't know how to incorporate time here.
Because
we are like, we have no global information. And that's exactly now also the problem when you're once in a local minimum, you're just following the local minimum because you're never optimizing globally. You cannot jump back to the actual global.
And it's probably better to have a way to do step by step that then learning like a slice of time, and then the neural network breaks for any time longer than this. Yeah,
exactly. And like there comes then the problem. First, you need an exact reference if you want to train it and like actually want to go beyond like what can be done with other methods. And if you want to do the prediction, you would be more in this black box business. It's okay. Like you can also like still estimate some errors, but they would not be numerically exact anymore.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Can I ask another question? Or sorry. You want to go ahead?
Very nice talk indeed. It was really nice. So as far as I understand that the bottleneck is basically this kind of stochastic reconfiguration kind of optimization of your parameters and the preconditioning of your X matrix, right? So I want to make a correlation with Stephanie Wong, because you said that size is not the problem, but it's because you have so much noise in the S matrix. But in the results that you showed, it seems to me that you didn't use an RBM anymore, but you use a CNN. And if you use a CNN, the idea of the size of the neural net is different, right? It's no longer like the width of your RBM where you scale the number of hidden states, like the alpha parameters, but not only you have already the structure of your Hamiltonian because it's transitionally invariant, plus you have the depth. And I believe that, I mean, size of the neural network, width and depth have, I mean, probably different kind of effects on the accuracy of your answer, right? So say, for example, you use your preconditioning of the S matrix and use an RBM. Will you see an advantage compared to Stephanie results than using the CNN?
Not really. I think so. Like, honestly, I don't recall like whether we did exactly the case of Stephanie, but we have certainly played around a lot ourselves with, say, I think I can just probably repeat myself. I'm trying to say something more than I was just saying before. I fully agree in the end, like probably that if you have local, like that the structure of the neural networks should at some point matter, really, that in the sense of that a CNN probably, like if it's sufficiently deep, it can somewhat better capture your quantum state. But there's something like completely weird happening, say, like there's also one example, like that's our benchmark, low level, like our benchmark problem. It's a 1D Ising chain. It's very similar to what Stephanie was like considering. And there is a point in time where there's no feature in any physical quantity. Yeah, like it's like boring dynamics. Yeah, there's nothing happening. But no matter which kind of neural network you choose, everything explodes at a particular point in time. There's nothing obvious. There's nothing happening. There's nothing physical apparent what should happen. You can even choose RBMs, CNNs, RNNs, recurrent neural networks, like where you could imagine that you get the very different landscapes and like some things should change, but it does not. Like it's, I don't know. What I want to say with this, I very much agree, and that was also like my initial guess. There are some other issues which, as you can hopefully as I try to emphasize, we don't yet all fully understand, which are still the limiting factors. So all the data that I've shown you also like for whatever, this one here, we stop at some point because there's now an instability. Yeah? Something crashes. But this is an instability which we have not understood. Like, and up to this point, you can see actually various different network structures. We have also done RBMs. All of them look the same. There's no difference. But here something happens. God, we don't know why.
Yeah, I understand. So, then it really decouples the point, right? Between the architecture and the optimizer you use, right?
In other words, we are currently not yet at the point where the structure of the network makes a huge difference. Somewhat like the states are easy enough that they can fit in any of these networks. And like what we have achieved up to now is like going from somewhere here, like to here. Yeah, that's what we have achieved with various tricks. Now we want to go further, of course. But for that, we need to understand what is now causing the problem. But like we have actually ideas of like there's something we are currently pursuing. So actually we have found a way to do global updates, which are extremely expensive, but to do global updates at least once or twice or like a few times a simulation. So not like at every point that you propagate, but at a few points in time. And like it sometimes works, sometimes not, but like for like a similar case, we have been able to go across one of these instabilities again by using this global update. These are tricks we are currently trying to play. Sorry?
Global updates in this scheme?
Yeah, you have to do something different, like not within this scheme. So you have to do something completely different.
Spin system, do you like flip a lot of spins at once? Is it what you mean by global?
No, sorry. Like what I mean is like really searching for a global minimum. It's like not doing this local in time update. So really doing like a full stochastic reconfiguration in the full variational parameter space, but without knowing the exact solution. Like that's a bit the problem because you don't know exactly. So it's a bit tricky, but we found a way. It's extremely expensive. And therefore, we cannot do it very often, but maybe this helps us now. It will certainly help us now, to which extent we have to see it.
All right, sounds good, thanks.
Yeah, cool, more questions?
I have a question. So you said something interesting where whatever architecture or neural network you're using, it doesn't really matter. They're all expressive enough that you can solve your problem. I can think of one example where expressivity isn't an issue, but trainability is, which is the Barron plateau problem in quantum neural networks. And I'm just wondering maybe if you can comment on how trainability of neural networks fits into this complexity of the algorithm or expressivity of certain neural networks.
Yeah, the most straightforward thing I can say here is probably that this is probably much less machine learning than real-time dynamics than you might have expected. Because we are actually, it's also a matter of wording in the end, but we are actually not doing real optimization. We are real optimization in the sense of using stochastic reconfiguration or whatever to search for like a minimum in a complex variational manifold. We are doing something to some extent simpler that we are always very close to the actual, like, the way we are doing it, we are always very close to the actual global minimum. And we are only optimizing locally a bit further to get get back to the minimum. So like a small time step in the end means that we are only slightly changing the variation manifold. So it's easy to get like locally back to the actual global minimum. And therefore, the optimization problem like we are solving here is much, much simpler than any other like of a like really complex machine learning issue.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I have another question about the when you showed the signal to noise ratio of your differential equation, and you, if I understand correctly, the problem is not in the ill conditioning of the matrix you're trying to inverse, but on the other side, and you're trying to thresholding this. Have you considered other possibility than a simple threshold, like by assuming some shape for the rest of the matrix, or? And because when you do the threshold, I suppose it corresponds to kind of a maximum entropy regularization on that part, right? You kind of ignore a lot of information, so you suppose you don't know anything, and it sets an averaging or something.
True, like so. It might like really appear like a bit arbitrary, like also like to put this here. And we also tried like how is it called, Tichanov regularization? I think like taking not a hard cutoff, but rather like a smooth cutoff, which is more than a step function. This didn't really make a huge difference, as at least concerning the problems that we were looking at. So I think the key insight was a bit that like the problem is, as you were saying, not really like small singular values. The problem is amplifying. So like in the end, small singular values would correspond to large values on the right-hand side. So amplifying with a small singular value, which is irrelevant, amplifying just noise up to infinity.
Yeah.
So like that's what we are avoiding here. So just taking into account those contributions which are not noise, but defining what is noise and what is not noise is arbitrary. Yeah, like that's
okay.
So what you need to do is also to study like the dependence of your result upon changing the threshold.
Yeah.
And we have found that it depends more like on the, it's actually a little bit subtle in the end. You have to be really careful about setting the threshold. But it's not so much about actually the shape of the cutoff. It's more like where you cut off.
And what's the relation between, do you see a relation between where you cut off and the point in time where you lose the tracking of the exact solution?
It can make a huge difference changing this threshold. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So there can be a sweet spot, and typically the sweet spot is very important to really push things that you get something interesting. So you can easily fail by choosing the wrong threshold here.
And right now in this study you just varied it by hand and found one that was good, or did you have a way of systematically optimizing this threshold?
No, in the end it's like to some extent you have two knobs which do the same thing. Like either you choose, you modify the threshold, or you increase the number of your Monte Carlo samples.
Okay.
Both somewhat do the same thing. So typically it's like optimally you would study convergence, but for study convergence you would more like increase the number of Monte Carlo samples, and it would automatically would be equivalent to modifying this threshold itself, because it will automatically change the signal to noise ratio with the different level.
Thanks.
That's what we are typically practically doing. So we have a good choice, like here, like this has been certainly like that has been the result of like trial and error. And now like we have a good range of threshold, and then it's more like playing with the number of Monte Carlo samples to see convergence.
That's super interesting. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have more questions. So if not, I think we had a great discussion already. So I think we can stop here.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks again, Markus. This was really a great talk. It was nice to have you here.